But after you have Moll Flanders, you have Fanny Hill and things like that. And Fanny Hill is basically, I mean, even today, you would consider Fanny Hill basically sort of an erotic novel. I mean, the novel was going in definitely the wrong direction for being respectable. So Richardson very much saved the novel in that sense. Now, you had, after him, you had people like Fielding with the things like Tom Jones, which are still quite racy. But there was a strong tendency for a sort of a respectable novel alongside the Gothic novels. But increasingly, you didn't have so much sex and relative raunchiness as you did in something like Moll Flanders or Fanny Hill. So women could pursue novel writing without it being sort of a direct route to the gutter, etc. It could be something that was respectable if they demonstrated themselves to be respectable. Why would you want to write novels as a woman, but not plays or poetry?
Because it's easier.
You could get into a lot of trouble.
Yeah, poetry is supposed to be more, like you said, of high quality.
Possibly, but it depends.
Structure and it's,
do you know the famous quote about James Joyce? One of his friends met him just after lunchtime one day, and he said, "How are you going with your novel?" He was writing Ulysses at the time. And James Joyce said, "I'm having a problem with a sentence." And the friend said, "Well, you can't find the right words." And he said, "No, I have the right words. I just haven't got the right order yet." You can write novels in such a way that it is as sophisticated and as time-consuming as writing poetry. Perhaps you just have to rhyme a bit. What's the problem with poetry? What is the big problem with poetry? No, that's not the big problem. How many people can you name who got rich from writing poetry? Nobody. Nobody ever got rich. Nobody ever earned a living from writing poetry. Poetry is a bad idea in terms of financial independence. You can write poetry if you are maintained, or if you are an aristocrat, or if you can live from a private income of some sort, but you can't write poetry to earn a living. Not a good idea. Nobody reads poetry except for English students in class, in UNED, and people like that. So why not write plays? You can make money writing plays. Afra Behn has been writing plays. What's wrong with plays? What's wrong with plays? Only rich people, good. Did it work?
It takes a lot of money to put them on stage.
It can take a lot of money to put them on stage. It's not a particularly good moment for the English theatre. There's not a lot of people paying for new plays. It's much more interesting to produce a play which has already been accepted by the censors, so you don't have to worry, and you just do new things. You have a new way of presenting the ghost in Hamlet. And this is, of course, still true. If you put on Hamlet or Othello or Romeo and Juliet or three or four other plays by Shakespeare, you will make money in Britain. If you put on Pericles, Prince of Tyre, or Troilus and Cressida, or even the Comedy of Errors, things like that, you won't make money because people want to see the big ones, the ones that they've heard of. That is how stupid people are, but that is how they are. So that is the same sort of situation there. Why would you want to risk money to put on, to produce a new play when you don't know if it's going to work, when you know that Hamlet or The Beggar's Opera is going to work. Similarly, why are you going to risk your money buying a theatre ticket to a new play, which may be rubbish, when you know that Hamlet is good for your soul? But more importantly, because you do have men trying to write plays at this time, like, for example, a man called Henry Fielding, who has had them systematically banned by the censors. If you're writing plays, that is part of a public role, as public literature. And you can't really write a play under another person's name, because you're normally going to be involved in the rehearsals, etc. And people don't expect that. Plays are not anonymous. So you become a public woman if you write plays as a woman. And being a public woman was not being respectable to these crazy, crazy people in the 18th century. However, if you write a novel and you send your novel to a publisher, you don't even have to give your name. You can send somebody round with a fake beard on and get a contract signed or whatever, and then you can reveal, once the thing has been a success, that you are a woman. So you can be judged on the same level as a man. People will just assume that you are a man until you say otherwise, and you can use the false name of a man, as people like Charlotte Bronte and her sisters did, as all sorts of people did. Some people had directly professional names as writers, like George Eliot, which were masculine, not her real name. So, of course, that again comes down to our times. J.K. Rowling was advised by her publisher to use her initials rather than calling herself Jane Rowling, because it was felt that teenage boys would not want to read a book written by a woman. How sad is that? Anyway, at least they were talking about teenage boys. I had a Spanish student in one of my classes about 25 years ago, it is true, but who basically said he would never read a book written by a woman because he didn't think that women could write anything worth his while to read. Incredible. But anyway, he was relatively young. Maybe he has matured since then. We also have a coming together of the literary forms of female writing. So women, until this time, wrote things called letters. In the 20th century, children, people used to write letters to each other, and they would be quite sophisticated. And of course, that produces the epistolary novel. And women are heavily involved in letter writing. Yeah? It's perfectly acceptable, and you obviously want to be in touch with your family and all sorts of people. So people are writing letters on a huge, I mean, people who are literate and have a bit of free time are writing a huge amount of letters. And as I said to you in a previous class, there is the situation where, certainly by the early Victorian period, you have 5 deliveries of mail a day in London. So you have this situation where somebody can go to work, they can see the amount of work they have, and they can send a letter home saying, "Hello dear, I will be back at work for 5 or 6 or whatever," and you can count on it getting there. I mean, this is an incredibly sophisticated system, pre-telephones, pre-emails, pre-telegrams, etc., etc. They're not meant to be read. Letters, quite possibly, sometimes. Women are involved in writing diaries. Yeah? So that is another form of intimate writing. Oh, plays. No plays. They're not meant to be read. Plays are not meant to be read. Well, it depends. All of Seneca's plays were written only to be read. So it depends a little bit, but anyway. It's slightly different, and obviously you don't generate money in the same sort of way. Conduct books. Again, that because you are talking about a situation where now increasingly girls and young women are being educated, there's very much the idea of being educated for a reason, being educated to find a suitable husband, etc., etc. So we're talking about something which is a cross between, I don't know if these things still exist. When I was a child, people used to talk about Swiss finishing schools. Do you understand what I'm talking about? A finishing school is a school where you send a young lady to, a teenage girl to become a young lady. So typically they would go to somewhere like Switzerland, and they would probably learn a good level of French as well, and have learn some piano, and learn how to get out of a Rolls Royce with a thing on their head, sort of Lady Diana type culture. So there's elements, if you like, of that type of culture. I'm in Switzerland right now. Are there finishing schools, Douglas? Have you seen any as you travel around Switzerland? Verbier, I don't know what that means. Well, anyway, that idea of at a very high level of society is part of that, and so you produce all of these books, which are, this is what a lady should do, and this is what a lady shouldn't do. And so, all of those different types of literature are incorporated into the female novel. And it's important to understand that in most cases, most female literature in the 18th century is pretty damn conservative. It's about not creating waves, not getting the patriarchy riled up. So you are writing novels about the dangers of it for a young woman and the sort of minefield that she has to cross before she can find Mr. Right and settle down happily ever after as a contented little wife. This is not stuff that would make very many feminists happy. It's pretty damn conservative. Okay? But there is a demand for this type of thing. And of course, a lot of books are going to be bought by men for women. So by towing that line, by maintaining rather than questioning the patriarchy, that is something which is works quite well. The other thing is that novels can earn a hell of a lot of money. Evelina, written by Fanny Burney, earned her what a governess would earn in about 200 years. Literally, 200 years, one novel. Now that is the most successful female novel of the 18th century, not all. Female novels were that successful, but still, I mean, if your options are sort of needlework or being a lady's companion or being a governess, and you can earn 200 years salary in 1 year writing a book, that's obviously not a bad option. And so most of the women that we have in this period are writing for money. Perfectly respectable thing to be doing, but that's what they are doing. There is also a legal reason why women might want to go into novel writing or just professional writing. What is that? Well,
a legal reason?
In most cases at this time, in this dark time in English history, a wife's property was her husband's property. One of the few exceptions to that, by one of these strange quirks of fate, was her literary property rights. So one of the ways that a woman could earn an income, which was hers and not her husband's, was to write novels. So that obviously makes it hugely attractive compared to almost anything else you can do, and there's not much you can do as a woman, it has to be said, because it is your money. A lot of the advances in British society happen because of this type of omission. So, for example, I mentioned to you that the cabinet system, that the British government being organised in a cabinet system, was because the king couldn't understand the French that people were trying to speak, because he was German and he spoke no English, and the ministers couldn't really speak French, and they certainly couldn't speak German, so there was no way of communicating. So he said, get on with it, I'll eat a lot of food and sign bits of paper, and that's how we will organise the government. As a quirk of history, but that is why, that is how that type of constitutional democracy was born, by that process. Similarly, in the Victorian period, when people were organising the law for pharmacies, for chemist shops, as we call them in English, they forgot to mention that this wasn't a profession for women. So the 1860 pharmacy law came out, and it did not prohibit women from having pharmacies. So suddenly, women said, oh yeah, pas me. And the pharmaceutical profession became flooded with women. And of course, it is still a scientific profession which is dominated by women, both here and in other places, because of this omission. It wasn't intentional. But you know, the fact that those who are controlling things forget to put in all the details, people take advantage, thankfully, of those loopholes. So, there are, from 1752, a number of biographical dictionaries of female worthies. So you have books which compile the short lives of women who had an unquestioned reputation for decency. So you wouldn't have had anybody like Cleopatra or people like that in there. You would have very, very saintly, virtuous women. But you have increasingly, as already exists with men, with these types of short biography collections of short biographies, you begin to have them for women from 1752 onwards. But the most obvious change is the arrival of the blue stockings. Bam, bam, bam! The arrival of the blue stockings. And we change slide, we change slide. So, we have the arrival of the blue stockings. What was it? That was what we just answered. And there she is thinking about the answer. And then we move on. So, the blue stockings. Blue stocking in today's English, it's a bit of an old-fashioned word, but it is a word that we would use to describe an intellectual woman. It's slightly pejorative, and it's not offensive, but it is slightly pejorative. You imagine a little bit sort of a spinster, blah, blah, blah. Women are not sexy if they're intellectual in patriarchal culture, as you know. So there's a little bit of those sorts of ideas behind it. But anyway, in the 1750s, Elizabeth Montagu started a salon where she invited her literary friends, both male and female, to come and have a chat. Now, what most people of high society did at this time was to go and play cards, maybe drink a bit of coffee, drink quite a lot of brandy, and gossip, and do everything that you saw in The Raven's Lock. Dancing and cards and dancing. Not very intellectually challenging, but there you go. So, Elizabeth Montagu was a young woman who married a man who was about 30 years older than him. She was about 20 and he was about 50. And they actually had quite a happy arrangement, because he was a member of the aristocracy, but he was also a mathematician, and he was obsessed about mathematics. And he went happily about doing his mathematics, and she went happily about doing her life, and they got on reasonably well doing this. And his money came from a number of coal mines in the north of England. And as the Industrial Revolution was beginning, well, at this time it's more the Agricultural Revolution, but you have increasing demand for coal, for energy, all these types of things, and it was quite a profitable thing to do. And in fact, Elizabeth was quite heavily involved in running the family businesses, because he was often his sons. He was only interested in mathematics. But she had quite a lot of free time also in the summer, for example, to come down to London and to organise her salons and to entertain herself intellectually. And she was basically in a situation where she had enough money to get all of the intellectual people at the time, people like Samuel Johnson and people like that, to Edmund Burke, Reynolds, the painter. The top level of English literary and artistic society to come and have a free dinner so they can all talk about interesting things. And also female friends that she had who were writers. And so this created, as it were, a safe space in which women could be intellectual. Okay? Now, a certain man who is basically a botanist called Benjamin Stillingfleet was a guest at these meetings, but because he wasn't very rich, he could not afford to wear the sort of formal clothing that you would expect from a Darcy or one of these types of people who are of a high level. And so he came to these meetings wearing blue stockings rather than the evening dress. And what a lot of the other people did was to adopt his type of clothing so that he didn't feel out of place. And so that is why they started to be called the blue stockings, because the socks that they wore were blue, he wore were blue, and they all started wearing them. And because the exceptional thing about these salons was that they had quite a lot of women there, blue stocking began to be used to refer exclusively to intellectual women. That is the origin of it. So, now, this is not entirely invented by Elizabeth Montagu. One of the main inspirations for this type of salon, and therefore the name, is the French salon, where the French also were before this doing getting intellectuals together to have a chat. So that was also happening there. And to a large extent, the blue stockings were an imitation of that. So who are we talking about? Well, we're talking about people like Elizabeth Carter. Elizabeth Carter when she's young, Elizabeth Carter when she's a little bit less young, Elizabeth Carter when she's even a little bit less young, Elizabeth Carter when she was middle-aged. What do you know about Elizabeth Carter?
Nothing
at all. Elizabeth Carter was a translator. She translated, famously, she translated Epictetus. And her translation of Epictetus from ancient Greek was famous throughout Europe. But she was lucky enough to have a father who decided that she should receive, her father was a clergyman. You will find that large numbers, a very significant proportion of the writers in the, certainly in the British tradition, I don't know so much about the American tradition, are the children of clergymen. It's easier to be the child of a clergyman in Britain than it is in Spain, for obvious reasons. But why do you think so many writers were children of clergymen?
I think they had access to education.
Good. But not? Yes, she was a polymath. But not lots of money. Somebody who's a clergyman, typically, for example, if you're in the countryside, you will be educated with the children of the local aristocrat. He will say to the clergyman, because of course the aristocracy wants the church on their side, send your son or your daughter along to be educated with my children. Yes? And they will be civilized playmates for the aristocratic children, and they will also receive an education. The renewal of a capital, so one of your options, male or female, is to go into literature. And of course that is the case of Tennyson, of all of the Brontes, all sorts of people have clergyman parents. It's very, very common in the British context. So she was a polymath, but above all she was a pretty damn phenomenal linguist. She spoke all sorts of things, French, Latin, Greek. When she was young, she published some poems, I think, when she was about 17. And she taught herself Arabic and Portuguese when she was an adult, blah, 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 blah. And of course, there's no sort of Linguaphone or one of these apps to learn a language which make it easy. This is a complicated time to be teaching yourself lots of languages. But by the end, she had about 8 different languages that she could speak. So we're talking about a pretty intellectual woman, one way or the other. And she was the oldest woman in the Blue Stocking circle. We also had and because of her poetry, she was known as the rightful heir to Alexander Pope. We also had Elizabeth Montagu, who I've already talked about. These meetings were held at her house. She is the woman who married the mathematician aristocrat. And here she is, being very young and a bit less young and a bit less young. Well, I don't know, it's all a bit complicated. Similar sort of age, at least. The three small ones. But anyway, there she is. And she was known as the Queen of the Blues by, I think it was Johnson who called her, I'm pretty sure it was Johnson who called her the Queen of the Blues because of the blue stockings. Yeah, that's referring to. Now, she said that she couldn't create anything of importance apart from, or anything except for marmalade. Yeah, so she made a damn wicked marmalade. Marmalade is nemelada naranja in English. She was, of course, being very modest. She wrote some very fine essays on Shakespeare, for example. She is one of the reasons why Shakespeare went in the mid 18th century from being one of the great Renaissance playwrights to being God. I mean, British people from the mid-18th century until recently, and still some people do, will treat reading Shakespeare or watching Shakespeare a little bit like a religious act. Okay, it's what we call bardolatry, from bardo. And people, as I say, treat it as if, and a lot of people in America do the same. Shakespeare is something that intrinsically is going to be good for you, good for your personality, good for your soul, morally good for you, etc. Completely ridiculous attitude to literature. Shakespeare wrote some rubbish, he wrote some very good stuff as well, but he's not as exceptional as that view would like to suggest. So she started her salon in 1750, and by the way, her younger sister was the well-known novelist Sarah Scott, who you've never heard of. But anyway, her sister was also a novelist, etc., etc. So she is, if you like, the mastermind behind the Blue Stockings, but she is also a perfectly intellectual woman in her own right. And then we have Charlotte Lennox, who founded the Eurythmics. Well, you have to be old to understand that joke. Nobody understands my jokes anymore.
That was Annie Lennox,
not Charlotte Lennox. Yes. Charlotte Lennox is famous for writing The Female Quixote, which you will probably insist on pronouncing The Female Quixote, but you should pronounce The Female Quixote, because in English, yes, people understand my jokes. Which was subtitled as I didn't write it down. But basically, it is subtitled as sorry? The Adventures of Arabella. And it is quite possible that the reason that she called it The Adventures of Arabella could be a veiled reference to Arabella Fermor. Who's she? Arabella Fermor was the woman who inspired The Raper's Lock. So, why would Charlotte Lennox do that? Well, if we're talking in The Raper's Lock a little bit about the minefield of young female experience. You understand when I say minefield? Yeah? This book is very much about the same sort of thing, about young women's progress in society to find the right mate, the best possible man that she could find. All of this type of writing, of course, is very, very fertile territory for literary Darwinism. What is literary Darwinism? Have you heard of literary Darwinism? Well, it's one of the movements that later than things like neo-historicism and cultural materialism and all of that nonsense, where it looks at novels from the perspective of evolutionary psychology above all, and seeing how, for example, seeing novels as, in this type of situation, as a mating ritual, like those birds which do little dances around each other to try and find the best possible mate. It is one way, quite an interesting way, I think, of understanding a lot of this type of literature, which is about how you find the best partner, which from a male perspective is the most beautiful young woman with a perfect reputation, where you know that your children are you, that her children are your children, and from a female point of view, being able to distinguish between the cad and the dad. Do you understand that? Dad means a good father. Somebody who you're going to get married to, he's going to have children, and he's going to take care of his children. And a cad is a mujeriego, a bad man, somebody who just wants sex. So what young women have to do is to be able to distinguish between good marriage material, what Seth, the Indian, you know the Indian novelist, Seth? His surname is Seth. But one of the great modern Indian novelists wrote a book which is called A Suitable Boy, which is all about those processes, basically in India. Big thing like that, thick Indian novel. That is the crossing that obstacle course, as it were, to not lose your reputation, but to get into contact with enough men to get the right one, who is going to have enough money to maintain you, and going to be a good father, etc., 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 is a lot of what this type of literature is about. She was very much admired by Richardson and Johnson, but she was spurned as unladylike by the previous Elizabeths, both of the other Elizabeths. Basically, the big problem was that she had been brought up in America. I think she was actually born in New York, terrible provincial thing to happen to you, and she had also grown up in Gibraltar, which is almost as bad. So these snobbish English ladies who were a little bit older than her didn't really see her as quite ladylike, not really acceptable. But the men actually saw her as a better novelist than everybody else in the company. So, moving on, in order of age, a little bit younger was Catherine Macaulay. And Catherine Macaulay was known as the female Cicero. They all have these ridiculous titles, but it can be quite helpful in terms of remembering who they were. And she also got older, but she maintained the same nose. You can very much see there that this is the same woman, partly because it's the same posture more or less, but anyway. So she wrote, Burke had wrote a history of Britain, I think it was called, and she wrote, which was very much a Tory history of Britain, and she answered this with a history of the English people, or something like that. I can't remember the titles, it doesn't really matter, which was a Whig, so a liberal history of the country, which was also very highly considered, especially, of course, by people who were Whigs, because it agreed with their ideas. And so she actually has an important place in what we consider Whig history. What do I mean by Whig history? No es la historia de las pelucas. What is Whig history? Whig history is the concept that, in broad terms, society constantly improves. That we move toward, little by little, gradually. There may be some very short hiccups, but we move gradually towards a more liberal, a more tolerant, and a more democratic society, and more there is the rule of law. So, for example, if you are a Whig historian, you think that Adolf Hitler or Donald Trump are aberrations, but generally speaking, we are, you know, democracy gets extended across the world, and the rule of law gets extended across the world, and we all are gradually better people, etc., etc. And of course, at any moment in history, you could argue more for a more cynical model, or you could argue for that. You could say, you know, the broad trends of history are towards this, and you have certain aberrations in places like Russia or Turkey or the Philippines or Belarus or the United States or half the bloody world at the moment. But that is just a hiccup in the general trend towards democracy. Yeah? The number of countries, at least which call themselves democratic and have regular elections now compared to 1970, is vastly more. Now, the number of countries which have truly functioning democracies compared to 2000 is substantially fewer. So both views of history are possible, and you're always going to be in a particular moment, so who knows. But that is what you have. Okay? So she is actually very important in that Whig view of history. And sorry, I didn't mention, I should have mentioned before, Catherine, not Annie Lennox, had a big influence on Northanger Abbey. A lot of Northanger Abbey by Jane Austen is sort of parodying and in relation to that. Yeah, sorry. She wrote A History of England to challenge Burke's Tory, A History of Great Britain. And this moves us on to the most successful female author of the times, the famous Hannah More. Have you heard of Hannah More? No, you haven't. There is a reason for that. Okay, Hannah More. She was the most successful female writer of the time, economically speaking. She is, in a literary sense, the worst writer of this group of people. The reason that Hannah More was so economically successful with her writing was that she wrote very simple pamphlet type books, which were bought en masse. They were bought in bulk by landowners and by clergymen who had money, to distribute for free amongst working people, because they were considered very improving in that sort of sense. So she, more than anybody else that we're talking about, participates in the patriarchy and participates in the aristocratic or the elitist society, and benefits from it. So you have the huge paradox here of a woman who never got married and was financially independent, one of the very few women who was financially independent because of her writing, who spent most of her writing time recommending that women get married and are submissive to their husbands. So we have a word for that, which could be hypocrisy. But anyway, she was known as the bishop in petticoats because she had the sort of conservative values of a bishop, but she wore enaguas, she wore petticoats. As you will see, all of these people have silly little apodos, or silly little epithets, but they can be useful or not, as you prefer. So that is her. And she was the big adversary of a woman called Mary Wollstonecraft. We'll talk about her later, especially next week. And then we have, of course, Charlotte Smith. Charlotte Smith, who looked like that, but also looked like that, depending on the day of the week. She looks quite Spanish there in her headdressy thing. But anyway, this is a nice sketch. I like that. So, Charlotte Smith, in 1793, she was more on the liberal side of things, on the weak side of things. She wrote a book called The Old Manor House. And the strange thing about The Old Manor House is that it is quite evidently anti-British imperialist policy. And the other thing which is hugely important, and in fact is very modern for its time, is that in The Old Manor House, 1793, the servants, believe it or not, have complex psychological lives. It's crazy. Yeah? Instead of having a book like Jane Austen's novels, where the servants are invisible, they just don't exist. Yeah? They exist as much as your washing machine or your dishwasher exists. Here you have as much emphasis on the complex social and private lives of the servants as of the masters of the house. And so this is hugely influential in everything from upstairs, downstairs, to Downton Abbey, and all of that nonsense. But Charlotte Smith was also important in terms of her novel, her sonnets, and her poetry was really quite, was recognized as influencing by them Wordsworth and Coleridge. So she actually, you know, interested in things like nature and ordinary country people and this type of thing in her poetry, had quite a big influence on the early Romantic movement. So, not an unimportant woman, shall we say. Yeah? She's, nobody really reads her novels or her poetry anymore, but she did have quite a big influence. And then we come to the most successful novelist of the age, who is Fanny Burney. Frances Burney was rather an attractive photograph. I think that would be by Reynolds. I think that's Reynolds. Well, it could be Gainsborough. But anyway, you can see also how very, very rapidly the quality of portrait painting was developing in England at this time, from the different portraits of people. She was called by Virginia Woolf the mother of English literature. She is the only one of these women to write a novel which continues to be read outside the 18th century. So, I mean, this is a novel, it's not hugely popular anymore, but it is a novel that people still read. And certainly was successful into the 19th century. So Evelina is an epistolary novel of sentiment. It is a Bildungsroman. Yeah? So it's very much the same sort of structure as the Female Quixote, but more intellectually sophisticated, more sophisticated in a literary way. She spent the first half of her life trying to keep Daddy happy. The first thing she did to keep Daddy happy was when she was 15, she burnt all of her juvenilia because her father and her stepmother disapproved of her writing, which is probably quite sad, especially since she had started to write Evelina when she was 14, so some of the early chapters of Evelina were already in her head. And because she wanted to keep conservative Daddy happy, this is Evelina is quite conservative, and her novels become more and more conservative as she progressed, but also because that is what public taste demanded. She was a lady in waiting to some queen or other, Queen Charlotte, I think, something like that. And at one point, she was chased around the royal gardens by mad King George. King George III, of course, went mad and had attacks of bouts of insanity, and she was involved in the court there. But after being a lady-in-waiting to the Queen, she married a French emigre general, and they were very, very happy together, which is nice. Unfortunately, she was in France when the Napoleonic War started. So she had lots of money coming in to her publishers from writing Evelina, and she couldn't get the money. And she was stuck in France for quite a long time with her husband during the Napoleonic Wars, for about 10 years. Her husband fought at Waterloo, and she was at Waterloo, and she, had to go find his body. He wasn't dead, he was unconscious. He had been kicked by a horse and was left unconscious. So again, if you are aware of Les Miserables and the whole idea of sort of the battlefield at the end of that, he was one of those bodies sort of suddenly... What I really don't know is which side he was fighting on. Because as an emigre, he was presumably a royalist. But since they've been living in France for all that time, I don't know whether you start fighting for the French or for the British, for the alliance. But anyway, it doesn't really matter. 3 years later, he died anyway. But she went on, as you can see, to live to a good old age. She died in 1840, having returned to England. And then we have our old friend, Anne Radcliffe. And the problem with Anne Radcliffe is you can't get a good picture of her. I don't even know if this is meant to be her, or if this is something they just stuck on the cover of one of her books, The Sicilian Romance. But anyway, it doesn't really matter. The interesting thing about Anne Radcliffe is that she is somebody who actually grew up in the Blue Stocking circle. So she is completely another generation from the older women. If you have a situation where we were saying that, lots of these women were born around 1730. This woman is 34 years younger, so we're now talking about the second generation. But most of these women lived to a good old age, so they obviously lived a reasonably healthy life for the time period, and so they're all interacting with each other. But she was actually brought up in this circle, and of course she is very, very important in the history of the Gothic novel. especially writing Gothic novels, which were, as with Scooby-Doo, as we saw, she influenced Scooby-Doo, not the other way around. All of the mysterious stuff has an explanation. And if you pesky kids haven't, So, we have these wonderful people. And in 1776 or something like that, a painter, whose name I cannot remember, thank you, paints this, he knows this by heart, actually, paints this picture of all of these happy women sitting together. So, I can tell you who they are. This woman here is Angelica Kaufmann. Qu'est-ce que c'est que ça? Quien es Angelica Kaufmann? Angelica Kaufmann was born Swiss, but naturalized as an English person, and she was one of the founding members of the Royal Academy of Art. And that is why she has a palette on her finger and an easel in front of her, because she's painting. And she was really quite a, and she's the first major British female painter. She was really quite good. And behind her and above her is Anna Letitia Barbauld, who was a poet and a writer. And here we have our friend Elizabeth Carter, the translator. They all look much younger, I think, than they were at the time, but that is the advantage of being painted. And the person in the middle singing is Elizabeth Sheridan, part of the Sheridan family. Of course, the Sheridans were important playwrights, Richard Sheridan. And she was a singer, which is one of the reasons why she is singing in the painting to her lyre. And this is our friend Catherine Macaulay, the historian. I can't really say anything interesting about her, but there she is. And the person in the middle is, unsurprisingly, Elizabeth Montagu, who is surrounded by all of her blue stocking friends. And then down here on the far side, we have Elizabeth Griffith, who was a playwright who has largely been forgotten. Up here, we have our friend Hannah Moore, the writer. No, sorry, this is Hannah Moore. This is Catherine, this is Charlotte Lennox with her Spanish guitar, probably because she came from Gibraltar. So, very, very happy scene of happy people. And in the 1770s, Britain was congratulating itself and congratulated by continental writers for having such a mixed intellectual society with lots of intellectual women as well as intellectual men. Everybody happy. And then things went south. Things went pear-shaped. Why? What went wrong? What went wrong was, firstly, well, no, not really firstly. I was going to say, firstly, there's pesky Americans, but above all, the French Revolution. And the French Revolution suddenly meant that you had to choose sides. So you had all the people on the liberal side of things who, at least initially, were quite in favour of the French Revolution. It was more or less acceptable to be in favour of the American revolutionaries at this time. But being in favour of the French revolutionaries was one step too far. The American Revolution was always going to be a bourgeois revolution, which was relatively civilized and well organized, etc., etc., and relatively untraumatic for England. Whereas the French Revolution tried to isolate England and was a much bigger threat because they were executing aristocrats and doing terrible things like that, which you're not allowed to do. So the conservative people like Hannah Moore and Elizabeth Montagu and Elizabeth Carter, etc., all formed into one group, and the more liberal people like Catherine Montagu, not Catherine Montagu, Catherine Macaulay, and a young woman called Mary Wollstonecraft and Mary Hayes, and people like that formed into another group. And from this lovely scene, idyllic scene of these happy women, you go to this, a contemporary picture of the breaking up of the Blue Stocking Club by Rawlinson, I think this one was painted by, which of course is a caricature. It's not actually physical violence. But these people who had been getting along for decades, and even despite their political differences, you could have political differences and still have an intellectual conversation, it's not a problem, become absolute deadly enemies. And the beginning of the end, well, I mean, the cause of this was the French Revolution, people's attitudes to the French Revolution, but the beginning of the end happened when Catherine Macaulay did a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. When she was over 40, she married a 20-year-old man. She married her doctor's younger brother, which was terribly scandalous. Demi Moore. So for us, no big deal, but this at the time was completely unacceptable for people like Elizabeth Carter and Elizabeth Montagu. It was also, to some extent, he wasn't of the same class. So there's a class element and there's the toy body element. The fact that he was young, and also the fact that he was of their class, etc., etc. And so this was, she was 47 and he was 21. And you know, sort of thing which maybe people would raise an eyebrow about and then not even bother to comment on nowadays, but not this is a different time period. And so she was viciously attacked by the Elizabeths. And they all started saying things like, this is all because she liked to wear men's clothes and dress up in silly clothes and do this and that and the other, etc., etc. And she was defended vehemently by Mary Wollstonecraft and Mary Hayes. And then everyone started hating each other and being nasty to each other. And the height of all of this, I mean, the reason, if you like, behind all of this was that the Elizabeths, the conservative side of things, wanted to be able to continue to write and be intellectual with the permission of the male establishment. And so it was incredibly important to be respectable and doing things like marrying a young man who was less than half your age was not respectable. And of course, they were under even more threat because the enemy were French. And so they could be accused of practicing French culture. If you consider the Blue Stocking Club as being a salon in the French sense, then they were automatically likely to be suspect. So it was incredibly important to be towing the line, behaving yourselves, behaving the way that establishment wanted to, and not questioning British imperial policy, questioning the patriarchy, questioning all of these types of things. And so they were desperate that these other women were not going to rock the boat. Of course, the more radical women, their attitude was, they will accept us if they have to, and if they don't want to, they're not going to accept us. What is the point of writing things that perpetuate the position of women in order that we as a minority group can have a few more freedoms? Doesn't make sense. You win your freedom against oppression, you don't, you're not allowed your freedoms. But it doesn't mean anything if you're just being allowed to do so. And of course, there were also men involved, people like Horace Walpole, who must have been very old by this stage, attacking Mary Wollstonecraft, calling her a hyena in petticoat, which is a very amusing image if you think about it. In a hyena in Aguas. I don't know if anybody has actually ever tried to paint that, but that's a good image. The things came to a head in 1798 when a churchman called Polwheel wrote a poem called The Unsexed Females. Now, unsexed sounds to us a little bit like somebody is not having sex. That is not what he means. Basically, what he is talking is the expression unsexed female comes from Macbeth in relation to Lady Macbeth, and it's talking about women who are not behaving in a feminine way. And so he wrote a very silly poem, which nobody would remember if it were not for its historical importance, about basically portraying these women who followed reason as devils who were destroying society. And of course, the great Satan was Mary Wollstonecraft. And on the other side, you had angelic women writers who were fighting against them. So it's a sort of two-bit Paradise Lost, written by somebody with very little poetic talent. But this sort of very much illustrated the type of situation, and this was enough of a public scandal for you to have famous caricaturists like, as I say, Rawlinson, I think it is Rawlinson. I can't see that anybody has actually signed it. Was it by Chomsky? I'm not sure. Anyway, there's a lot of caricature art at this time, one way or the other. It's very big in the transition between the 18th century and the 19th century. And it's actually very, very interesting, a lot of it. Anyway, unfortunately, the Elizabeths were either right or wrong, but basically, because of all of these scandals, etc., etc., the idea of public literary women was, the door was closed on it in Britain for the 19th century. Many of the greatest writers in the 19th century, like George Eliot, or Jane Austen, or Charlotte Bronte, or Anne Bronte, or other Brontes, or even poets like Christina Rossetti, who we will see, or Elizabeth Barrett Browning, blah, 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 so are women. But they are women who are writing from the private sphere. Yeah? They are not part of a public, open expression of literature. And the same thing happens in art. Angelica Kauffmann and another woman were amongst the founders of the Royal Society of Art in the 18th century. No other woman was allowed to join until 1920. Shocking. But you can see that women were excluded from public expressions of this. And you also get very much from this stage a sort of a hierarchy in all sorts of types of artistic expression. So, for example, it's okay for women to paint watercolours. Watercolours are great. Watercolours are good for women. Not a problem. But historical scenes should be painted by men. Angelica Kauffmann was painting lots of historical scenes. That was fine at that time. But afterwards, in the 19th century, you have modes of artistic expression that are okay for women, other modes that are not. And of course, novels become acceptable for women, much more acceptable than poetry. Now, again, we have the chance fact that novels in the 19th century become what most of us understand as literature. So fortunately, women were directed towards what was to become the most important aspect of literature in the last 200 years. But it was because they were basically being pushed out of poetry, which became more and more marginalized, as it is today, and not really encouraged to write at any theater. And still now, there's relatively little theatrical production that is feminine. I mean, there's some, but women, above all, write novels. And women dominate the field. I mean, you have obviously people like Dickens or Trollope or people like that, Thackeray, who are men in the 19th century, but the most famous novelists, apart from Dickens, in the 19th century are women in England. So that, if you like, is why. And that's it. Nothing else to say. So, ask me some questions. Are you all happy with your PEC?
Yes.
Yeah. No problems?
Not really. I can't come down with the centuries because there are many things that happened in the 18th century that some of them happened previously in the 18th century.
Wow.
So, I don't know.
Well, you can talk about, one of the ways to get around that is to talk about the long 18th century.
Okay.
And the long 18th century basically includes pretty much anything after Milton and goes on until basically 1790. I mean, it's obvious, there's, you know, centuries are nice, they're very rounded, they look nice, but the reality is that the French Revolution and romanticism mean that there is an antes and an ego's place, there is a before and after. Now, that is partially true, and there are dangers in seeing too much of that. One of the dangers in seeing too much of that is that people tend to, I mean, Jane Austen is a writer of the age of romanticism, but in fact, she is a continuation of a lot of what these women were writing. There's much more sort of neoclassicism there, etc., etc., and not a great deal of interest in what the romantics are interested in. It's quite difficult to write a romantic novel because romanticism is about emotional intensity. And you can't really maintain emotional intensity of the sublime over a novel. Yeah? You can have a poem where you get really, really, really excited. Yeah? And you're talking about spirits and existentialism and seriousness and all this sort of stuff. But you can't do that over a novel. So there aren't really romantic novels. And when the romantics are writing longer pieces of writing, they tend to write in Gothic mode. Because you can write a Gothic novel. Yeah? With its ups and downs. So, that is not a criticism of Jane Austen. Jane Austen takes the novel hugely forward from where it was. I mean, you compare anything written by Jane Austen with Evelina, for example, by Fanny Burney, and you can just see the huge advance in terms of how she uses the narrator, the irony, the humour. Much more complex, much more interesting writing. But it doesn't really correspond to the Romantic period. And similarly, the Gothic continues, you decided I finished, I think. The Gothic continues until Frankenstein, and of course the sort of definitive version of Frankenstein is 1830. So it's actually pretty much in the Victorian period. Obviously the first version of Frankenstein was written in 1818. Yeah, be careful with centuries, but as I say, the use of the long 18th century sort of covers your back a little bit. So that's quite a good term to use.
Okay, well, my question was because we want to talk about society and several things happened during the 18th century, I would say
you're basically talking about something vaguely from around 1690 to something around 1790. And in some cases, you're probably maybe a little bit earlier, but that's not really in terms of what we've been studying. It's much more sort of from 1712, from the Rape of the Lock, whatever, until the French Revolutionary stuff, and all that goes down.
Yeah, well, 1714 for the French Revolution.
Yeah. Okay. But yeah, I mean, don't worry too much about those sorts of labels.
Yeah, just to emphasize the due to the, for example, mentality,
yeah.
I want to be sure if it was in the 17 or in the 18 or part of the one or the other one.
After you've had the restoration in 1660, it's a relatively gradual process. I mean, the French Revolution is good in that it creates very much in a couple of years, obviously not one day to the next, but it creates very much a sort of before and after. And people like Wordsworth, and then people like Shelley, etc., are very much influenced by the actual fact of the French Revolution and are thinking in those types of ideas about liberating society and blah, blah, blah. It actually impinges on people. It's not like sort of talking about the 7 Years' War, which was very important for England, and it's very important in terms of defeating the French, certainly the monarchical French regime, the Ancien Régime, as a military power, and Britain becoming the number one superpower for a bit. But doesn't really have very much influence at all on literature. Like the French Revolution does, because everybody has to choose sides. And the British government becomes quite repressive. You have quite a lot of people being executed in the first decades of, during the Napoleonic period in England, etc., etc., etc. Wordsworth is followed by government spies. There are government spies against William Blake, etc., etc. So all of that is important for changing the nature of society. But yes. Thank you, Doug. Well, we will continue. Next week, we will look at Mary Wollstonecraft, the mother of
Mary
Shelley. And the week for our Christmas class, we will have a Christmas class about Frankenstein.
Okay. I think in this week and I have already read Frankenstein. That's why I read a lot today.
But Frankenstein is not...
it's very interesting,
yeah.
Because when you... there is a misinterpretation about this book.
Oh, of course. Yeah,
the name and also the story itself. It's completely different from the
ages that is related to Frankenstein. Yeah. We're going to be, the idea of beginning on Teams would be that we begin when we come back in February. Okay? Because I have to get permission and have to organise it with you, Ned, the easiest thing will be for us to do it in February rather than for these last two classes, because it doesn't really make a big difference. I think I can do it. I will be able to do it for the two classes on. Thank you very much for the two classes on Pride and Prejudice that we have in January.
Okay.
Okay.
And this is another book that is on people's.